are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Wallace Wells on the uninhabitable earth, life after warming. Meanwhile, Trump attorney Don McGahn blows off the House Judiciary Committee hearing as impeachment demands rock the Democratic caucus. And speaking of which, a federal judge upholds the congressional subpoena issued to Deutsche Bank. Appeal is on the way to the D.C. Circuit Court, which is chaired by Merrick Garland. Well, that guy. Speaking of chairing, Ken Cuccinelli, he of the vaginal fetal probe, has been appointed immigration czar in the wake of a report that a 16-year-old Guatemalan boy died in DHS custody. We have dual hearings in Congress over the Iran policy. Intelligence liars in one hearing. Non-intelligence liars, I guess specifically about the Iran situation, in another. And local Georgia DAs say they will not prosecute under the newly passed Georgian anti-abortion law. EPA announces they're ending funding into environmental threats to children. And Fox News' Pete Hegseth turns out to have been the main pusher of pardons for accused war criminals. Meanwhile, Italian unions refuse to load a Saudi ship in a Yemen war protest.
Hell yeah.
And Bernie will be showing up at the Walmart shareholders meeting representing the Walmart workers.
Good morning, everyone.
And lastly, the heartwarming story of the Alabaman public television station that refuses to run a cartoon because it mentions gay marriage. All this and more on today's program. We forgot to listen. We forgot to look up the call I did back in the day to the American Family Association. I don't know if they're still around anymore. I think they are. But they had a culture desk there that did a report on, I think it was Finding Nemo or a Shark's Tale, and blowing the lid off of a Shark's Tale, how it was pushing cross-dressing, where you have, you know, I think a shark pretending to be a dolphin or something, and this was sending the wrong message to kids. We have that audio somewhere. I was going to introduce that.
Another element of that movie was pretending sharks could speak.
That was also,
there was a lot of imaginative life.
Dangerous message.
Dangerous message. But that was inspired by this story out of Alabama. Alabama Public Television has chosen not to air the PBS's Arthur episode This is, of course, the episode which aired nationwide on May 13th. Arthur, who is a, is he a lovable mole or something like that?
I think he's an anteater.
Anteater, sorry. Aardvark. Yeah. Arthur, the aardvark, and his friends attend their beloved teacher, Mr. Ratburn's nuptials to his partner, which turns out to be a male, whatever species Mr. Ratburn is. Alabama Public Television was on it very quickly. They preempted the episode by showing a rerun of a different Arthur.
I'll recuse myself.
Yes, Mike McKenzie, the director of programming at the Alabama Public Television, say they were notified by WGBH and PBS in mid-April about the episode entitled Mr. Ratburn and the Special Someone and decided to show a rerun. They have no plans to air the thing later. McKenzie said in an email saying that parents have trusted Alabama Public Television for more than 50 years to provide children's programs that entertain, educate, and inspire. More importantly, although we strongly encourage parents to watch television with their children and talk about what they have learned, parents trust that their children can watch APT without their supervision. We also know that children who are younger than the target audience for Arthur also watch the program. No explanation as to why that would be a problem to watch a wedding. But, I mean, it's, you know, I will tell you this. After they're done with abortion, they've just, I mean, you have state after state now showing that they are aggressively looking to revisit a decision that was made in 1973. So if you are under the impression that states like Alabama, Mississippi, probably Missouri, maybe Georgia, Tennessee, conceivably, I don't know.
Missouri.
Yeah.
And don't, I just want to say, too, and don't forget that the whole context for this, even in a place like Alabama, but certainly Georgia, is that this stuff is paved by voter suppression, you know, in to a significant extent. And that was already made possible by Roberts Supreme Court several years ago.
Well, yes. But my point being that if you don't think that they're going to reengage, Kentucky maybe even, if they're going to reengage in the battle to fight against marriage equality and not get help from the Supreme Court, I've got a bridge to sell you, or really just about anything, because I'm going to make it up. I'm going to make up the thing that I'm going to sell you, and you're going to sell it to me because you are naive. I mean, you're going to buy it from me because you're naive.
Yeah. Our buddy Steven Crowder, who used to voice a character on Arthur, has since gone to Twitter, and he takes censorship very seriously. So he's said, oh, wait, that he hasn't said anything about censorship. This is, do you want to see his reaction?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he's very concerned about censorship. Here it is.
PBS's Arthur. Mr. Ratburn, the teacher, he came out as gay and got married on the season 22 premiere.
Yep.
This comes from TV Line. Comes out in an episode titled Mr. Ratburn and the Special Someone. Mm. Now, this comes as a little surprise to most with longtime fans. They're setting Mr. Ratburn's obsession with cleanliness, fashion. Yeah. In episode 246, Mr. Ratburn gets AIDS. One was in which Spinky also controversially joined ISIS, which seems as though it was kind of a giveaway. So it seems, as though that...
Oh, I get it. Being gay is like joining ISIS.
Yeah, and only gay people get AIDS.
Good stuff.
It's hilarious.
Good stuff. Very funny stuff. I am so glad that I am so glad because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who'd want to chill that kind of speech, and we wouldn't get the insights that come from that caliber of comedy. The old, I'm an adult, and being gay is like being in ISIS. God, I'm going to be laughing for a long time.
This must hit pretty close to home for him, because it's the only real thing he's ever done.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Must be tough to see that
Who's saying being on wayside. YouTube isn't real.
See them move from strength to strength without him.
Folks, are you trying to drink more water? You should be. The amount of people I know who need to drink a tremendous amount of water to avoid like getting headaches or getting sick by the end of the day. And specifically, the other day, Mila is one of those person, my daughter. She had a headache. She needs to drink a lot of water to stay hydrated. I'm not exactly sure what the deal is with that. But when she came to me, I haven't drank enough water today. I got a headache. First thing I do, grab from my stash a liquid IV. It hydrates you 2 to 3 times faster and more efficiently than water alone, with an added bonus of vitamin C, B3, B5, B6, and B12. She should be drinking this one of these every morning. It's the fastest growing wellness brand, Liquid IV, and you can find them everywhere, even Costco. Liquid IV to fuel tough workouts, help prevent muscle fatigue, promote healthy post-workout recovery. Great alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks because there's no artificial flavors or preservatives. In fact, it's non-GMO, vegan, free of gluten, free of dairy, free of soy. Better yet, comes in a convenient TSA-friendly powder packets that are perfect for travel. That's when I use it the most. Well, travel, because I tend to drink a little bit more. I don't know why that is, but also you get on a plane, and it's like it completely dehydrates you. Prevents jet lag, altitude sickness. Try and keep some in the office. We have like 1 or 2 packets left. I love Liquid IV. I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 25% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. It's 25% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Just go to liquidiv.com, enter my promo code MAJORITY. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today. Also, you'll notice today that I am clean shaven. Usually that only happens when I'm going to go on television, but I just got a little bit itchy because of the heat yesterday, I think. And but when I shave, I should have like a label on me when I go on like on Chris Hayes' program, like a patch, like I was like a race car driver with Harry's. You know what I love about Harry's? I've told you this before. The narrower razor head, that's part of it. Somebody actually the other day a friend of mine noticed that I do have an asymmetry in my nostrils. And people don't generally notice, but I was like, that's why I need the trimmer.
Good observation.
That is why I talk about the trimmer blade on Harry's.
It's like Coming to America joke.
Yep. Harry's founders were tired of paying up for razors that were overpriced and overdesigned. They knew that a great shave doesn't come from gimmicks like vibrating heads, flex balls, or handles that look like spaceships. So they bought a world-class blade factory in Germany, started making razors that combine simple, clean design, quality, durable blades at a fair price. Harry's replacement cartridges, just $2 each. And all Harry's blades come with a 100% quality guarantee. It's no surprise they've received over 20,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot and Google. You can get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle. That's also one of my favorite things. The 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade. Rich lathering shave gel. Travel blade cover. And listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majority report. Make sure you go to harrys.com/majority report to redeem your offer. Let them know I sent you to help support the show. So a story today in Politico. Apparently there was a big meeting, Democratic caucus, in the wake of Justin Amash, this Michigan Republican congressman, libertarian, outlier, definitely. But he has called for impeachment, says the threshold's been met. And so you have members, according to this Politico piece, of the Democratic caucus leadership, Jamie Laskin, a couple others, Raskin, I should say, who he is a constitutional law professor. They want to start proceedings largely because this is all about the obstruction now is really the straw that's broken the camel's back for Amash and for others. When you start impeachment hearings, I've said this in the past, the weight of a congressional subpoena under the auspices of impeachment inquiry is simply heavier, and as judged by the courts and from a political standpoint. And this Amash thing, and yesterday I said it made it bipartisan. And I was being a little bit trollish with that because I sort of hate that construction that one member of a party can make it bipartisan. But particularly when you're talking about the Republicans who simply, it's a fact, march in lockstep far more often than the Democrats. But just even broadly speaking, there is something between bipartisanship and partisanship, right? That it's not necessarily bipartisan, the call for impeachment now, although there's members of both parties. But what it does is the knee-jerk reaction that Republican voters have, that the only reason why the Democrats are pursuing this is because of partisanship. That no longer works in the same way. It creates pressure on Republicans because if it was just partisanship, it would be a no-brainer for every Republican to say, I'm not signing on to it. I was talking to Brendan about this beforehand. The analogy he made was, you know, it's the difference between, like, it's a crack in the ice. The ice hasn't broken up, but the ice is not rock solid. And that crack has relevance. It creates pressure. And apparently, though, Nancy Pelosi still being adamant that the play here for Democrats is to just pursue serious bipartisan legislation, like things like enhance the Do Not Call registry and, look for an infrastructure bill that will never happen. And
maybe we could do a fraudulent bill with Donald Trump on infrastructure to privatize toll booths.
There you go.
And maybe you'd appreciate a few less calls at night, Samuel. I bet you would.
Here's Mika one-on-one with Speaker Pelosi right after that meeting, I believe.
Justin Amash's position on impeachment, he's tweeted more today. He's come right back at the president. Does it fit the bar for bipartisan support for impeachment?
Well, the bipartisan support for impeachment has to be in the Senate.
Yeah.
In terms of Congressman Amash, his voice speaks to the silence of so many other, all the other Republicans, not to hold this president accountable for the oath of office that he takes to protect and defend the Constitution, respecting the co-equal branches of government. So Amash may be one voice, but the fact that it is in the absence of other voices, it speaks very loudly.
So doesn't it put more pressure on you that a conservative Republican says the threshold for impeachment has been met?
No.
No?
No.
Why?
Well, we have to, this isn't about politics, it's not about passion, it's not about prejudice, it's not about politics, it's about patriotism, and it's about the presentation of the facts so that the American people can see why we're going down a certain path.
That is one of the most incoherent responses. The only thing that strikes me about this, she says, it's not about politics, not about passion. It's about patriotism and presenting the facts. The only thing that strikes me about that, that makes any sense whatsoever, is that it's all peas. And she's for some reason, I feel like there's some type of code there. Like we're only going to speak in alliterations. And therefore, I just don't know what the therefore part is. But it's clear that she has a plan, and it's just to speak in alliteration.
But
here's the bottom line. The first half of her response, that Amash understands that the president is completely obstructing the job of Congress. We just heard this from a federal judge. It makes absolutely no sense that Congress has an impeachment power and that they have oversight authority if they don't have authority to investigate. It is a complete undermining of our constitutional structure, what the White House is doing in terms of, like, keeping Don McGahn from testifying, keeping Mueller from testifying, Bill Barr not showing up. This is, I mean, I think there are other reasons to impeach Donald Trump. Again, read the report. Read the Mueller report. It's pretty stunning. You had Michael Cohen apparently told lawmakers, right, this would be part of an impeachment hearing, that Donald Trump's personal lawyer told him to lie to Congress. Basically said, perjure yourself. This is all impeachable. And the idea that Pelosi can say at least Amash has principles and is showing up the rest of the Republican Party. The bottom line is, if you don't pursue impeachment in this instance for the obvious obstruction, you're basically saying that's it. Congress loses the power. This is a use it or lose it type of situation. You won't remove Donald Trump from office. But what you will do is lay down a marker and say there is a thing called accountability. We may not be able to remove you from office, but we can impeach you. We can put it on record that you've been impeached. And from a political standpoint, it seems impossible to me now that this is tenable, like that this is some type of recipe for winning. I mean, I guess maybe there's some type of 14-dimensional chess where Nancy Pelosi wants to be, you know, lead from way behind. But I just don't think that happens in this scenario.
Can I just add two really quick things? One, it's incredibly frustrating also because when she speaks like that, she makes it sound as if Hamas is doing a Jeff Flake thing, which is exactly the opposite of what he's doing.
Right.
To be really clear, if you read his Twitter thread, this is not a, you know, I'm a Republican, but I'm a little bit fed up that Donald Trump is such a jerk. He is giving the most clear and cogent breakdown of, and again, we can, I mean, part of the reason that I don't put much energy into this is because it's, to me, it just seems demonstrable that they're not taking their functionality seriously. But he's just saying, look, this dude has clearly obstructed justice. This has happened. It's documented. It's clear. He's doing it right now. And therefore, as a good libertarian constitutional nerd, our job kicks in to do X. It's the opposite of the type of posturing that she's talking about. It's a clear clinical case. And she's failing on both counts because she's not connecting with the grassroots Rashida Tlaib, let's just impeach the MF-er because, of course, F him, or the... this is actually a thing. Right. This is actually a job that we actually theoretically do this.
Yeah, if it's really about like patriotism and preserving norms and doing it the right way or whatever, they should be doing these proceedings as the information comes to light without regard to politics or when the election is. Or if she's doing some like 20-dimensional political chess, she should tell people that, like, we're going to impeach this guy. It'll be easier to do it after the election.
All right, gonna take a break in a second, but I should tell you this, with more than 70 sizes, including their signature half cup sizes, Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit and a premium feel. Just answer a few simple questions via Third Love's Fit Finder quiz. Find your perfect fit in 60 seconds. Then thanks to Third Love's 100% fit guarantee, you can wear, wash, and put your bra to the test for 60 days. And if you don't love it, you can return it, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own, with straps that won't slip, tagless labels, and lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. How do I know? Well, I don't know personally, but we have outsourced this to our official Majority Report bra tester, and this is the response that we got. They don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two, and they both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. There you have it. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to Third Love. spell it just like it sounds, .com/majority to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Wallace Wells. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Remember, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program David Wallace Wells. He is deputy editor at New York Magazine and author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
We spoke to you, I guess maybe it was around October of last year or so, based on a piece that you had written that was that makes up in some respects, you know, I guess almost one section of this book. And it was pretty harrowing. I wanted you to back with the completion of this book. And I have to say, like, I want to start here because literally yesterday, maybe it was 2 days ago, I was telling my daughter, she's got to eat a little more responsibly, you know, like a little less sugar and eat a little more protein. She's like, it doesn't matter. 12 years, we're all going to be dead anyways because of climate change. And stormed off. She's a teenager. But I also, we're all not going to die is basically what I yelled after her. But I mean, to a certain extent, she's right about how dire it's going to be relatively soon. And that is what you outline in the section on the elements of chaos, right? We really haven't come to grips with the sort of practical implications of what is all but guaranteed to happen at this point.
Well, I would say that both of you are sort of right. I think that it's inevitable that we get some additional amount of warming past where we are already, and we are already living on a planet that is hotter than it has ever been in the entire history of humanity. So everything that we know of as human biology, as human civilization, as history, as culture, all of those things are dependent on climate conditions and have evolved and developed under climate conditions that no longer hold. And it's as though we've landed on an entirely different planet and are going to have to figure out just how many of them will endure in this new climate situation, which is not just different, but it's changing even more and will change going forward into the future in some harrowing ways. There will be almost inevitably quite a bit more suffering from climate change than we've seen to this point. But I also think it's important personally to keep in mind that we're very far from the kind of scenarios that would mean, you know, the total extinction of human life on the planet. I think the likeliest outcome is that we, over the next generation or so, produce significantly more human suffering and simultaneously find a way to kind of normalize that suffering so that we look away from those who are in most pain and justify our own lives in part by considering just how much, you know, just how intense the competition for resources and prosperity has gotten. But I think that it would be an ugly outcome, and I'd really like it. I'd really hope that we might find our way to a kind of more empathic situation where, for instance, we would be moved by the fact that by 2050, some of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East will be made unlivable just by direct heat in summer, which means you wouldn't be able to go outside during the summer months without risking heat stroke and death. These are cities that today hold 10 or 12 or 15 million people. And it's one reason why the UN thinks that we could have, just by 2050, have 200 million climate refugees. We could have as many as a billion climate refugees, they say, which would be as many people as live today in North and South America combined. Or to be moved by the economic suffering of countries in the world around the equator who have already lost as much as a third of their potential economic output because of the forces of climate change. And by the end of the century, would have no hope of any economic growth at all because of the impact of climate change. Speaking globally, pulling back just from those countries that are being hit hardest, it's expected that the global GDP would be about a third lower than it would be without climate change by the year 2100. And that's an impact that's twice as deep as the Great Depression, and it would be permanent. So we have a situation where no matter where you are, no matter what kind of life you live, your life is going to be impacted, which is to say, in almost all cases, degraded and damaged. And yet there's also, it's also the case that climate change punishes us differentially. There are people who suffer most, namely those of us in the global south, and those of us who it will punish more, namely people like you and me who live in the relatively wealthy west. And while I think, you know, I think we can get too far over our skis thinking about climate change as a near-term extinction-level event, it's also the case that life is going to get quite a bit more difficult. And everything that we do on this planet, from our politics to our culture to our relationship to economics and technology, all of those things will be transformed by this force as well, as totally as, you know, modernity shaped everything that you did in the 19th century and, say, financial capitalism shaped everything you could do in the late 20th century. That's how profound, all-encompassing, and sort of all-shaking this force will be.
All right, there's a lot in there I want to get to. I just want to put sort of flagpole this one thing that you said at the very beginning of that, because we often hear and you know, I mean, this brings up a lot of other subsidiary issues, but I just, that part about the planet's been this warm before, but not when humanity has been around, right? And
yeah,
and in fact, you write that we would not have probably evolved if the timing was off in terms of like the warming of the planet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you pull back and contemplate the whole universe, or everything that we know about the universe, and how few of those planets, which is to say only one of those planets, has developed anything like the kind of life that we know on Earth. One of the major drivers of that, one of the major factors there, is that life is extremely fragile, requires incredibly particular things from its environment, and intelligent life even more so. Now, I personally think that if the planet was always as hot as it is now, probably humans would have evolved. It's also possible that we would have evolved and developed agriculture and civilization if it was always as hot as it is now. But, you know, the place where we did invent agriculture, the Middle East, it's already getting quite a bit harder to raise crops. And so at the very least, it would have been a more difficult innovation. And I think that starts to tell you, you know, just how dramatically everything that we know of as modern life is dependent on these climate conditions. We can think, oh, we're talking about an amount of warming that's 1 degree Celsius, 2 degrees Celsius. These don't seem like quite dramatic, quite so dramatic numbers. And in certain ways, they aren't. But when you realize that we have entirely left behind the window of climate conditions that have governed all of human history, it puts that in a quite different perspective. You know, the last time that there was this much carbon in the air, there were palm trees in the Arctic. The equator was hot enough that nothing like mammals could survive. And, you know, I hear from I wouldn't call them climate deniers, something more like climate skeptics every so often, who say, you know, the Earth has been this hot before. We've gone through cycles of warming and cooling before. We shouldn't freak out. And I say to them, you know, not just that, you know, as you say, that when the planet was warmer than this, there were no humans around, but that each time that we've gone through some of these climate change cycles in the past has been attended with what's called a mass extinction, with, you know, as much as 95% of all life on Earth wiped out by those changes. So it's not something that we can really afford to be complacent or blithe about, even if it's also the case that, you know, humans being humans, we're adaptable, we're resilient, we probably will find some way to endure and survive. The question is really transformed in what ways, with civilization and life changed, you know, in what directions. And I think that's one of the reasons I spend so much time in my book, you know, not just on the scientific understanding of what climate impacts are likely to bring, but really how those impacts might reshape everything that we know and take for granted about the way that we interact as humans on this planet. But, you know, we can talk a little bit more about the science, too, since I imagine that that's probably something of interest to
you. I want to get to some of that. I mean, we covered that, you know, the last time around to a certain extent. I want to talk about it in how, you know, how this information is processed, or to the extent that we are, you know, in denial in terms of the implications, maybe. But I just would just say that, you know, what if the planet was as warm as it will be when we were as a species developing, we simply would have developed in a different way, right? We would just not be necessarily on a trajectory create as many people. We would live in a very a narrow belt of the Earth, as it were. And but the fact is that, you know, it's almost like you move, you know, you're a band of nomads, and you stop by a riverbed and you build a society around that river, and then all of a sudden the river dries up. All the reasons why you were by that river still exist, except for now there's no water. And so that's basically sort of the analogy on some level. Let's talk a little bit about the normalizing suffering thing, because I mean, on some level, this is the process which allows us. I mean, let's put aside denialists, because you make the point that although the Republican Party is essentially the only institution on the planet, essentially, that denies what's happening, for the rest of us, more or less, because the U.S. only contributes to about 15% of the CO2 that's you know causing this problem. For the rest of us, we are in a different type of denial, right? Like we know it's bad. We're just not really. There's a lot of procrastination going on, and on some level, isn't it like that? Aren't we sort of almost like projecting forward to like we can deal with that? I mean, I just look back to over the past 15-20 years that we were at war in Iraq. Depending on whose numbers you want to believe, somewhere between 200,000 to 1 million people die because of our invasion, 4 million people displaced, 2 million internally, 2 externally. And you could walk around the United States and have absolutely zero awareness that any of that has happened, was happening, you know, at any point. And like, if our ability to do that when we were like literally directly, you know, the cause of that, it seems to me that our capacity to say like, what, some city in India, 1 million people? I mean, that to me seems like we're almost already doing that. It's already like baked into the way that we perceive this problem.
Yeah, we have an incredibly deep ability to normalize suffering. I mean, the example that I often use to illustrate it is there's a paper that came out about a year ago that completely horrified me, that was looking at just the effect of air pollution, the differential between what air pollution would mean at 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees of warming. Now, air pollution is not exactly an impact of climate change, but it's produced by the same thing that produces climate change, which is to say the burning of fossil fuels. And just between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees. We're at about one degree now. 2 degrees is what the level of warming that most scientists of the world consider the threshold of catastrophe. Island nations of the world call genocide. And we're on track for about 4.3 degrees by the end of the century if we don't change course. But just between 1.5 and 2 degrees, these scientists estimated, would mean 153 million additional deaths from air pollution. It's just from air pollution, just from that half degree extra of warming. And when I say that to people, when I mention that fact, you know, their eyes go wide, their faces go ashen, and they think 153 million deaths, how could we possibly conscience that amount of suffering? And they're right. It is an unconscionable amount of suffering. It's 25 Holocausts worth of dying. And yet, 9 million people are already dying every year from air pollution, which is a Holocaust and a half.
Right.
And you and I don't think about those people every day. We probably rarely think about them. And we're two of the more informed, engaged people thinking, you know, obsessing over climate change in general.
But we have that figure. I mean, you know, it's not a figure like, you know, we're not, it's not coming up on this show. I mean, on a regular basis. And yeah, I mean, I think like, this is what I do as a profession.
I've been even more than you. I mean, I've been working on this subject now for several years, really deeply in the research, you know, interviewing scientists, reading academic papers every day, trying to process, you know, all the news from science very profoundly. And yet I myself still live in compartmentalization and denial and complacency. I think that's a testament to just how intense and powerful those impulses are in all of us. We really don't like to contemplate bad news. We really do like to believe that, say, the lives of our children will be better than our own. We look outside our windows every day and we anchor our expectations for the future based on what we see in the real world today, even though we know when we think about it that there will be surely some additional warming, probably considerably additional warming. And yet we really we base all of our projections for the future, our emotional projections for the future, on our experience of the present. I think that's really, really deeply problematic. But there's also that same impulse towards complacency and denial at the political level, and I think maybe even most problematic at the geopolitical level. You know, the Paris Accords were signed now just 3 years ago, a little bit less than 3 years ago. They pledged rhetorically to keep the world to 2 degrees of warming, which is this level that the scientists call the threshold of catastrophe. But they actually only included commitments from all of the nations who signed on that would bring the Earth to about 3.2 degrees of warming. So they only got about halfway to their stated goal of 2 degrees. And yet no nation in the world is on track to meet those commitments, not a single one. Which puts American bad behavior in some perspective. I mean, I think we have a special obligation towards moral leadership on this issue, because historically we've been responsible for the lion's share of global emissions, even though now we're only at about 15%. But even so, all of the nations of the world that have much more progressive leaders than Donald Trump, all of the nations of the world who have much more green politics, much more left politics than Donald Trump, and than America does now, none of those countries are behaving significantly better than the United States. Some are behaving a little bit better. The UK has been doing really well lately. But we're all largely in the same position of not taking action at all. And that is ultimately a sign of what I think of as the problem of collective action here. You know, if the US completely zeroed out its emissions this year, it really wouldn't have a meaningful impact on how much we suffer at the hands of climate change unless the rest of the world followed suit, because most of the emissions that are being put out there are being put out there by the rest of the world.
Right.
That calculus is even more the case for most of the other nations of the world who have an even smaller share of the burden, share of the responsibility than the U.S. does. And that means that every individual nation, no matter how committed to the idea of action on climate change, is in a certain way incentivized to not take action and let the rest of the world clean up the mess. And I can see a way where individuals, through engagement and education, wake up to their own place in this story and become considerably more agitated. I think we're seeing that already, actually. The polling on climate change has moved dramatically in the U.S. and all through the West. People are much more concerned than they used to be, and the politics are beginning to reflect that. I think that politics will move even faster than we've seen over the last 6 months or 9 months. which is a time when, out of nowhere, a protest movement called Extinction Rebellion in the UK basically forced Parliament to declare a climate emergency. Ireland has now declared a climate emergency. The government of Indonesia has put forward a plan to really rapidly decarbonize. I think the politics is moving in that direction all over the world. What I worry most about is at the geopolitical level, which is how can we coordinate all of this action? How can we coordinate all of this energy? Because, you know, if you had to imagine a threat that was big enough, intense enough, all-encompassing enough to call into being a real network of global cooperation, climate change should be it. And yet we're staring down this real catastrophe at a time when we're simultaneously, so many of us, retreating from those commitments, retreating from globalization, retreating from the UN, and, you know, adopting much more zero-sum, nativistic, nationalistic sense of self-interest. And I think that that's, in the end, maybe going to be the hardest part of the puzzle to solve.
Okay, so let me, and I should say, just so that we can sort of like get people into some type of semi-optimistic frame here. You make the point in the book that the pace that, you know, contrary to, I think, what is conventional wisdom, you know, that it is not the problem that we have created is one that we have created relatively recently. Like, you know, they talk about the, you know, the hockey stick. Well, that hockey, the part that hits the puck was only about 20 or 30 years ago, right? I mean, this is not like, we don't have to go back. You make the point in the book that the problem has exacerbated much more so since the time that we've been aware there's a problem than before then.
Yeah, it's really one of the, it was probably the most dramatic awakening, moment of awakening for me in doing all of this research and reporting this book, when I realized that half of all of the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels have come in just the last 30 years. That since Al Gore published his first book on warming, it's since the UN established its climate change body, the IPCC. I say in the book, it's since the premiere of Seinfeld. We have done more damage to the future climate of the planet since the premiere of Seinfeld than in all the millennia that came before, all that human history that came before. And that's a kind of an indictment, since that means that we've done that damage knowingly, done more damage knowingly than we ever managed in ignorance. It also means that it also gives us reason to be skeptical that we could take action, dramatic action going forward, which is one really concerning fact.
I'm trying to look at it as optimistic to the extent that like,
yeah, I think that there is an optimistic line, which is, you know, when we think about just how fast we've done this damage and we think about all of the horrors that could be waiting for us down the line, ultimately, those are just a sign of how much power we have over the climate.
Right.
Which is to say, if we get to 4 degrees of warming, which will be hellish, it would mean twice as much war. It would mean climate damages globally totaling $600 trillion, which is twice as much wealth as exists in the world today. There'd be parts of the planet that would be hit by 6 climate-driven natural disasters at once. But if we get there, it will be because of what we do going forward. The driver of climate change on this planet is human action, which is to say how much carbon we put into the atmosphere. And we can decide how much carbon to put into the atmosphere. We have our hands on those levers. So if it's taken us 30 years to bring the planet from a stable situation to the brink of catastrophe, which is what we've done just in the last 30 years, we also have about that much amount of time to avert those outcomes, those really horrifying scenarios. And since I'm 36 years old, I think almost certainly my life will contain both of those stories, both the period of time when we brought the planet from stability to catastrophe, and conceivably the time in which we addressed the problem, took some action at least to avert some of these worst case scenarios. And that to me is an incredible story. It's an epic drama. I mean, really, I write in the book, this language makes me a little bit uncomfortable, but it's drama at the level that we used to only see in mythology and theology. We truly hold the future of the planet and the future of humanity in our hands. And you and I are part of that story, not just as passive listeners or watchers. everyone who's listening to this is a protagonist in the story and can make a difference themselves, primarily through politics, also through talking about it, et cetera, and to a limited degree through individual choice and like personal consumption habits. But we are all protagonists in the story, which is a huge, huge drama. In fact, I think it's honestly like the greatest drama of all time. And there is a way in which it can be harrowing, overwhelming, even paralyzing to think about all of the changes that we're going to see, even all of the changes that we've already seen. And yet, the scale of those impacts, as I said before, is ultimately a reflection of our power. Ultimately, if we take climate change seriously, it tells us that we are an incredibly powerful species that can write the future of the climate of the planet if we choose to.
So, all right, here's what I struggle with, okay? Because, I mean, and yeah, people can make personal consumption, habits, changes, but that's ultimately not going to be enough. It's not a bad thing to do. It's nice. It may have some political implications. I mean, in fact, maybe the political implications may actually have more relevance than the actual acts themselves. Because, you know, if someone sees you stop eating meat, let's say, that may have like, you know, political reverberations that have actually more impact than you just not eating meat. But it seems to me, or convince me of otherwise, I guess is what I'm asking. How is, in presuming that, like, look, I don't know, me living in Brooklyn, how much direct impact it's going to have on me, and maybe you can inform me, you know, so I can tell my daughter. But it seems to me that the prospect of me being able to implicate the politics on this is somewhere around the same as the prospects of me getting, several hundred million, earning several hundred million dollars and buying a farm up in northern Canada to ride this whole thing out. Like, you know, like when I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, like, I want to, what is the most rational use of my energies here? Is it to, you know, Peter Thiel this thing and go up to Canada and just ride this thing out? Or is it like put those efforts into trying to change the politics? Because both, frankly, seem to be a little bit pie in the sky at this point. Like, you know, like I say, you and I are the type of people who should be, we should be the ones who have had this figured out a while ago, and we're just having trouble convincing other people. And I still, for the life of me, like, you know, we don't cover this every day. I have no idea what the recipe is to impact what we as a species do.
Well, I think you're asking a number of different questions there, so let me try to get through as many of them as I can from how I see it. And other people see these things a little bit differently, but my perspective, first of all, is that the politics is moving quite fast. 73% of Americans now believe climate change is real. That's up 15% since 2015. It's up 8% since last year. By any political science standard, that is a dramatic change. The same dynamics are at play all across Europe, with real dramatic movement on concern about the environment just over the last few years. Mostly, I think, because of all of the extreme weather that we've seen over the last few years, which for the first time has really shown us that climate change is happening in real time. We had been taught for a very long time it was in the distance. We're seeing it now on our TV screens, especially in the summer, every summer. There is policy action being taken in many parts of the world that is quite exciting. I mentioned earlier this plan put forward by the government of Indonesia, which is really exciting because Indonesia is a developing country, and for a long time those nations were understood to face a choice. They could grow faster, pull more of their people out of poverty, or they could grow more responsibly and subject more of their people to more suffering. And it was understood that facing that dilemma, usually they would take the dirty industrialization route, give more wealth to their citizens, but at some significant environmental cost. In fact, that's what Indonesia has done over the last two decades, as they've halved their poverty rate, doubled their per capita income, but doubled their carbon emissions. Now, they say that they can halve their carbon emissions by 2030 and do so while growing at 6% per year, which is in fact faster than they've grown over the last two decades when they made all this progress. There is a kind of global new conventional wisdom emerging among economists who used to think that it was going to be costly and expensive to take action on climate, so costly it might not even be worth it in economic terms, even though there was a kind of humanitarian imperative. But now that logic has really reversed, in part because their estimates for how much economic suffering climate change could bring have grown so much higher. And now it really is the conventional wisdom that faster action will be better for us all. There was a major study in 2018 saying that we could add $26 trillion to the global economy by just 2030 through rapid decarbonization. So I see a lot of hope in the political, the movement on politics here. I think we were trained over the last couple of decades to believe that politics was really inert on climate, but I think that actually is changing. The problem is, you know, the UN says that in order to avert this catastrophic level of warming, 2 degrees, we need to have our global emissions by 2030, which they say would require a global mobilization at the scale of World War II. The Secretary General says it should start this year. It would need to start this year. So even though politics is moving quite rapidly, it's still not moving rapidly enough. That said, when I look at all of the alternative avenues ahead of us, politics still seems to me to be by far the most important path. And by that, my logic is this. I start from the understanding that in order to stabilize the climate at any temperature level, not just 1.5 degrees, not just 2 degrees, even if we were at 4 degrees, 5 degrees, if we wanted to stabilize it at those horrible levels, it would require not just reducing our carbon emissions, but completely zeroing them out. Because any additional carbon that we put into the atmosphere will cause additional warming. So if in order to stabilize the climate at any point, we will need to completely eliminate carbon. Now, how can we do that? Is it possible that the entire planet, to take the agriculture sector just for a second, that the entire planet would voluntarily, as a result of fears about climate change, go entirely vegan and entirely eliminate red meat from their diets? Is it conceivable that the entire planet would give up air travel out of fear for climate change? I think very much no. And to me, what that means is that we need policies in place to make that those sectors carbon neutral, even in ways that we will continue to use them, to rely on them, to appreciate them. So for instance, there is small-scale research that shows if you feed cows seaweed, their methane emissions fall by 95 or 99%. That's the main reason that cows are a carbon problem, is methane emissions. And if we legislated that all cattle farmers had to feed their cows seaweed, we could basically eliminate that problem entirely. The development, the R&D on electric planes and zero carbon planes is really preliminary. They've flown one plane over the ocean, over the Pacific, I think it was, but it was a really small plane. And we're very far from engineering planes that could carry hundreds of people, which are the kind of planes that we use today. But we need massive R&D spending in that area. And we probably also need legislation that requires airplane manufacturers to develop those technologies, and requires airlines themselves to put them into their fleets and retire the old planes. We simply won't eliminate air travel without policy. We simply won't eliminate the carbon footprint of agriculture without policy. There are some areas where the market and sort of collective action and individual action can make a difference. You know, it's already the case that in much of the world, renewable energy is cheaper than dirty energy. So especially if we eliminate all of the subsidies that we're giving the fossil fuel business today, which the IMF recently estimated was $5.2 trillion a year, those subsidies, I think we would see quite rapid movement away from dirty energy towards green energy. But energy is really only, I think, 35% of the problem. And there are all these other sectors, infrastructure, industry, agriculture, transportation, that are going to be much more complicated and which can only be solved through policy, especially when you remember that we do need to eliminate, zero out those carbon footprints rather than just reduce them. You and I could eat a few less hamburgers every year, but ultimately that's going to have a very trivial impact. And if we need to zero out the carbon footprint of hamburger meat, we're going to need to implement policy that requires it.
All right. So, David, and forgive me, I'm on, a little bit of a pessimistic jag here, but When we say
the science is pessimistic.
Well, yes, but I'm talking about when we say we, and we talk about the need for policy, right? That is it seems to me, a second order solution, or at least in the process in which to get to that policy, we need to first get to a we, right? Because on some level, then, I mean, we, you know, because like, for instance, Brexit, right? I mean, and there's polling that shows that most people in Europe think that the EU is going to go by the wayside. Put aside for a second the policy prescriptions of the EU, but the idea that you do not have, that you have less, you have more disaggregation rather than aggregation, that you have decentralization, means that the possibility to implement a policy, we need to develop these type of airplanes, or we need to do this and that, is less. Like, I mean, on some level, from a structural standpoint, don't we need an even bigger change that goes away from the market to build an apparatus to have that kind of policy? I mean, how can we do this without also addressing sort of broadly capitalism in some form?
Well, I think I think you're absolutely right that we need a major transformation of our cultural, political, and economic priorities, that we need to put climate change at the absolute center of our sort of view of the world and what needs doing, at the level of the individual, at the level of the community, at the level of the nation, at the level of the planet. At every level, we need a complete reorganization of our priorities. That's absolutely true. And I do think actually that climate change will cooperate with us in that respect, because the impacts will be getting more intense. We will start to see their fingerprints in more and more places. And I do think that we will evolve a sense of the future of the world that is really centered around this issue, in the same way that, you know, we used to center our view of the world around the sort of story of, say, neoliberalism or globalization. I often say I think we will have a legal order that evolves over the next couple of generations that puts climate change very much at the center of our understanding of our responsibilities towards one another as individuals and as nations, in much the same way that, you know, the post-World War II order really emphasized human rights and peace and prosperity. Now, we know that those values were often used as alibis for bad behavior. Right. Absolutely. I imagine probably the same thing will happen with climate change. But nominally, the West was committed to those values so intensely that they, you know, they went as far as, you know, fighting wars on in their name. They went as, you know, they imposed sanctions on one another and on other nations of the world if those countries were not behaving properly when it comes to human rights. And I think actually we're likely to see some of those same dynamics play out in relatively short order. On climate change, you can see the story already unfolding in the fact that MBS, the sort of putative and awful leader of Saudi Arabia, has said that his country needs to get entirely off oil by 2050 and mostly off oil by 2030. I think he understands that as soon as 2030, it won't be possible to be a country producing fossil fuels in the same way that Saudi Arabia has and still expect a seat at the community of nations. So I think the world will be transformed. Our politics will be transformed by climate change. The question is, will it happen fast enough, and will it push us in a more kind of collectivist, humanitarian, universalist view of our fate as humans on this planet, or will it push us deeper into a sense of nativism and self-interest, which is where we are now? And I do think that you're right, that's a very much an open question, and there's a lot of reason for skepticism. I do think personally that the experiences that we've had just over the last few years dealing with extreme weather have taught a lot of people that this is a force that is close at hand in time and in place, and which you may not be able to escape no matter where you live. I think that the California wildfires in particular were a really powerful teaching tool there. People even who lived very far from any forest that was ever going to catch on fire saw those images and imagined their own homes burning and really freaked out. And now there's also some perverse and grotesque elements of that as a teaching tool, because I think it was also the case that many wealthy people suffered, many famous people suffered, that made us respond to those images. But again, that's useful too, because it shows us again that there is no escaping these forces. And the more that we, as a species, understand climate change in those terms, that it is all encompassing, that it is everywhere, that it is inescapable, I hope that it will teach us to respond in a more universalist spirit. On the other hand, you know, I look around the world.
It could go the other direction too. Right,
totally.
Like
I mean
it could be the
election in Australia was lost by a Labor candidate who was pushing an aggressive climate action. He was widely expected to win. He had the polling in Australia was very dramatic on climate change, and that's a country that is, you know, generally speaking, it's the poorest nations of the world who are already suffering most intensely from climate change and will continue to suffer most intensely. Australia is a little bit of an outlier there because of where they are geographically. They happen to be a rich country, but they're suffering already quite intensely from climate change. And the public there seem to be waking up to that. This candidate was leading in every single poll for like a year and a half. And yet the coal-friendly conservative candidate was actually the one who won. I'm really concerned about the political situation in Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro, who's a kind of Trump of the Amazon, has pledged to dramatically cut down the rainforest there, to cut back the Amazon, open it to development in a way that his own country's scientists say would have the same carbon impact as adding an entire second China to the planet. And China's the world's biggest emitter. That's because most of your listeners probably know, but you know, trees suck carbon out of the atmosphere and they produce oxygen. So the more that we devastate our natural woodlands, our natural forests, our natural rainforests, the less our planet is going to be capable of extracting carbon out of the atmosphere, and the more carbon will be up there as a result. That's another reason that those wildfires I mentioned earlier are so scary. You know, California is way ahead of the rest of the U.S. on green energy. They're an incredibly impressive record. I think still not moving fast enough, but much faster than anyone else in the country. And yet, every single year now, so much carbon is released in those wildfires when those trees burn that it completely counteracts the progress that is made on those green energy initiatives. And that is just one of many, many, many horrible dynamics around the world where it's not just that we're not doing better. It's not just that we're not doing good enough. It's that we're triggering these, they're called feedback loops, that make the problem much, much bigger. At the moment, it is the case that the overwhelming driver of climate change is how much carbon humans put into the atmosphere, right, mostly through energy and infrastructure, agriculture, and industry. But say in 30 years, 40 years, if we continue on the pace that we're on, it is possible that some of these systems could sort of get outside of our control and become much harder for us to make a difference with, because the natural systems at that point will have sort of you know, started running away with the story, so to speak.
And we should also say that there is another scenario too, where, like, you know, as a nation, or as, you know, that nations take that sort of Peter Thiel route, right? Which is like, this is inevitable. So our solution is going to be more of a fortress than, and that could have some very, very ugly implications. But let me just, cause we'll run out of here, I want to just sort of like, you know, leave people with some type of like vague game plan. And short of, I will say this, if Tom Steyer is listening, I think a good investment would be take $500-700 million, create some type of hoax where it's like an alien invasion. Because I just feel like if we had something like that to focus on, like if it was like Independence Day, that movie, maybe, you know, it would be harder for the world community to be so disparate in its reactions. Like, you know, if we had some massive UFO like hovering over a couple of the world's capitals, maybe, you know, we could do it under that type of threat. But short of that, it sounds like the things that people can do on a daily basis, aside from altering their consumption, or maybe in addition to, is to help build the narrative of what of local phenomena being a function of climate change, you know, to the extent that one can make that that connection, whether it's the forest fires in California, or, you know, Hurricane Sandy in New York, or a drought somewhere, or extreme weather that is, the, you know, make that connection. And also, it seems to me, to support, you know, international, multinational structures. I mean, is that right? Is there something else that we can be doing on a daily basis to, you know, to the extent that we can, you know, butterfly wing this thing in terms of like helping, you know, toward a solution?
Well, I think the most important thing anyone can do is vote, and to vote for people who prioritize climate change. And then once those people are in office, hold them to account to those commitments. That's not an everyday thing, but it happens pretty regularly that there's some election in your community at some level. And I think in general, yeah, beyond that, the more that you can do to just spread the word, make connections, and make sure as many people are as concerned about this as is possible, I think that's all extremely valuable. In terms of motivating action, you know, the way I see it is the world is going to be transformed by climate change dramatically. Now, I think probably we're heading for a world in which most of that transformation is means more suffering. It's going to, you know, the hundreds of millions of climate refugees I mentioned, the unlivable cities, you know, the agriculture that could be half as bountiful as the agriculture we have today, public health issues that arise when mosquitoes that used to fly only in the tropics are now flying up in the Arctic Circle, which will be happening in short order, all the rest of it. The world will be transformed, but the world will also be transformed if we take action to avert it. The transformation is inevitable. It's a question of which transformation we want to choose. Now, do we want to continue subsidizing fossil fuels at $5 trillion a year? That is propping up businesses that would otherwise be failing and which are poisoning our planet. Or do we want to take that money and invest it dramatically in research and development and technology innovations that could help us address this problem? Now, I think it's important to understand this is not something that can be solved with a single silver bullet innovation. It's way too big a problem for that. But we do need technological help in every aspect of the problem. We need it to make renewables cheaper. We need better electricity so that the intermittency of renewables is not a problem. We need different concrete because at the moment, if concrete were a country, it would be the world's third biggest emitter. And China is now pouring as much concrete every 3 years as the U.S. poured in the entire 20th century. We need new kinds of agriculture, which could be largely technologically driven or, you know, with genetic technology in particular. We need these innovations. And we need them quite quickly, which means that we need to put an enormous amount of money and energy and attention on bringing them into fruition. Now, the choice before us is like, do we want to live in a degraded world where climate change has beaten us and sucked out our ability to produce economic growth and to live happily with one another? Or do we want to live in a world where we've met that challenge head on, innovated as dramatically as we've ever innovated, and found ourselves in a situation where human life looks in most ways the same? Now, I think that there's too much warming already baked in, and some of this innovation is going to be too slow to really avert some of these scary scenarios. I don't think that we're going to avoid 2 degrees of warming. I probably don't think we're going to avoid 2.5 degrees of warming. But, you know, when I get asked if I'm optimistic about this, I often say it's really a matter of perspective, because if what you base your expectations are is the world as it is today, you're going to be disappointed. There is going to be considerably more suffering brought about by climate change, considerably more. But I think of it as being much more reasonable, much more rational to base my expectations on where the world is headed, which is to say, like, the path that we're on. The path that we're on is for 4.3 degrees of warming by the end of the century. And as I mentioned earlier, that would mean double the war that we have today. It would mean a 30% smaller GDP than we would have without climate change. I think that we are almost certain to avert that level of warming, and how much we can avert is entirely up to us. So I think that we can, you know, if you base your expectations on that 4.3 degree level, personally, I'm quite optimistic. I think we'll probably avoid at least 1 degree of that warming and maybe more. But how much more is up to us, because ultimately, you raised a really good point earlier when you said, who is we? It's a really, you know, in certain ways, the critical question about climate change. Who are the political actors? Who has power? Who is making decisions? And especially when you see polling that shows so much concern for climate change, and yet you see politics that is, relatively speaking, inert, although it is moving much faster than it used to, it raises the same question. But when you do pull back and take stock of the story as a species, as a planet, I think you have to say we probably will do a lot over the coming decades to change the course of this story and to make the planet, a relatively speaking, happier, more prosperous, more fulfilling, and more just place. The problem is we're almost certainly not doing it fast enough to avoid outcomes that we today, looking forward, would consider catastrophic and devastating. But that gets us back to where we started, which is, I think the likeliest outcome is that we do that. We produce those catastrophic outcomes and we find a way to live with them and define them as normal rather than unconscionable. And that maybe is the biggest tragedy of the whole story.
Indeed. David Wallace Wells, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. There you have it. And
oh my God.
The end.
Like, the number of deaths that he cited that happen, will happen every year because of climate change is just an immense, immense thing to think about.
But well,
this is what I'm always saying, though. Like, I talk about how we need a revolution to progress past capitalism and impose some sort of central planning that would actually solve the problem. Maybe, I mean, like, a high percentage of the oil that's still in the ground needs to be left there in order to solve the problem. Does anybody trust corporations under the current paradigm to do that? I don't think so. I don't trust them to do it under capitalism at all. And people say, oh, you say you want a revolution. All revolutions involve at least some violence. But look at the violence of the status quo. Look at the violence that's happening now. Double the wars, he said. Like, that's something to weigh.
Yeah. I mean, I think the question is like, you know, what is the quickest route? What is the most direct route to mitigating the trajectory we're on now?
There's also,
and you know, that is ultimately the question. If there was a, you know, and is it quicker to simply say, like, let's raise taxes and buy or nationalize, you know, oil production, or cut subsidies and make it just not profitable? You know, one of the things that happened with TransCanada, for instance, was the pipeline. The thing that really slowed the pipeline was the fact that oil prices had dropped so much that it just simply did not become profitable to take those tar sands. I mean, that is, and that had nothing to do with any sort of major structural problems. That was just became unprofitable. And there's a multitude of ways in which you can do that.
Policy can do that.
Policy can do that. That doesn't necessarily need structural change. You definitely need an apparatus, some way in which to have policy that encompasses as much of the world as possible.
I just want to say two quick things. I mean, I tend to agree with Jamie on this in terms of, like, structural, like, I do think you need to it's not only a question of nationalizing these companies, you need to reassert that there are certain resources in this world, even in some type of social democratic whatever paradigm, that are commons, that are not privatized assets, particularly things that both as a, you know, I think Norway's gotten the equation right in terms of public distribution, you know, something that's just in the ground shouldn't be profited on slowly by private companies. But then on the other hand, obviously, we literally need to stop drilling. And I think that, you know, one axis, there's climate, but there is also justice. So somebody like Jerry Brown made some real strides on certain aspects of climate innovation, but not on the justice dividends, right? And then the second thing I would like to say, and maybe I'm contradicting myself a little bit here, but I do.
What do you mean on the justice dividend?
Well, climate is one area, and there is definitely a path where, at the very least, I think on the drilling and supply side, I think that's very hard to deal with that under capitalism. I do. But I certainly think that you could generate new markets and technological innovation, and that's what Jerry Brown was very good at doing. But when it came to, hey, I'm in a poor area and I don't want my town to be, you know, fracked You know, other area, other, or, you know, pollution is distributed in different ways. Global warming is going to have disproportionate effect on like indigenous communities in Fiji, as an example. There are these other quote unquote justice dimensions of this, which frankly, you can skip over in a Davos, Bloomberg, Brown kind of paradigm, right? Like you can cut emissions, you can upgrade the grid, you can change these things and still have a pretty systemic disregard for a fair amount of the population. So I think that that's one thing. But I, on a completely different end of the equation, and I might be contradicting myself, but I just want to be intellectually honest here. I think Adidas as a company has done a lot in terms of cutting emissions, in terms of what they do at their factories. It's just very innovative. And I just want to recognize what they're doing as a company and as an organizational culture. Thank you. Check it out, Adidas.
The people in the Discord notice that you're wearing all branded Adidas stuff and make a comment?
I think that a lot of people might or may not notice it, but it's really just something that I'm passionate about.
It really is, like, odd.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
as an aside.
It's just something I believe in.
It's really odd. Like, sometimes I know that Saul gets on a jag where he's like, he only will wear a certain type of clothing.
That's exactly right.
He's six.
Yep. Well, hopefully he won't. Hopefully he will have a greater fashion sense than his father. And also the sense to recognize when a company really is doing something for the most important issues that we're facing as a, as really a globe.
But I think, you know, getting back to Jamie's point, I think that, you know, David Wallace Wells was, the point he was making is that the impetus for that revolution, to the extent that it happens or not, is probably going to be less people deciding we need a revolution and more the functional equivalent of that UFO coming and pointing a laser beam and blowing up a major city.
Well,
in the context of I mean, it's just a question of whether we as human beings have the mental capacity to see these disparate things that are happening around the globe and be able to synthesize that and see it as coming, emanating from one problem. I mean, it's almost like when the government shut down, that dynamic where nobody felt the impact until it was about plane travel, right? Because plane travel is like a sort of a networked thing. And there was a, you know, one or two elements that could shut down a network, essentially. And I don't know if humans perceive the planet's ecology as networked in the way that it like obviously can with airplanes.
I think
was talking about the ways in which climate change is going to ramp up global conflict, right? So it might not be a UFO that does it, but the next world war will probably be a nuclear one.
But
so,
well, no, I don't. I
and then when that happens, it's going to cause massive unrest, and it is the job of the left to give a shape and a voice to that and make those connections.
I agree with
people.
That, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be more conflict is not necessarily going to be a world war, and it's not necessarily going to be nuclear. I mean, right now, can your average person tell you where there are wars going on in the world?
Well,
not even ones
is,
that we're
is,
involved in.
I think this is
but
part of the problem,
accelerate.
Though, that you that is both being identified and just in how we're framing this whole conversation. I think one of the limits of, you know, because there isn't just like a world and a planet and a climate that affects all of us equally, obviously. So when it comes to like, as an example, you know, I'm thinking of Fiji a lot because my friend Joshua Khan has worked specifically with that community. It's here. Like this crisis is totally here for them.
Yeah.
So they experience it as a non-abstraction, but they don't have any power. And so they're fighting against something that, you know, they're experiencing. It's totally real for them, but they don't have political capital. And it's going to hit us in the same way. So I think it's like the difficulty to me is that the conflicts will accelerate. They might continue to be on this low quote unquote low grade simmer that you're talking about for quite some time. And as long as you keep a certain amount of people with a certain degree of affluence and a certain degree of insulation, you can disconnect
that's
them.
That's what
from
I'm saying.
That. And
know,
that's the dynamic
the
we're already in.
Airplane analogy is the same thing. Yeah, it's like you're hitting people who are wealthier. You're talking about business travelers.
That's exactly,
and
that's
you're talking about you know, media people. I mean, that is that's the analogy.
Well,
that's the
you
analogy. But
use
if
that
you don't
analogy.
Inject justice, that's why I think it is important as a frame to at the outset frame it as both a scientific, existential, and global, but also a very nitty-gritty justice and power thing. Because if you at least start putting that on the table, in the same way that you're right about the government shutdown, but what should have kicked it off immediately was when it started jeopardizing people's food.
I get the should.
No. But we're fighting for the should.
But
that's why we do the show. Right.
Well, analogy,
I mean, we're fighting for it. You could be totally right. You could be totally right. And if you're right, there's a scenario where, you know, Peter Thiel is in a bunker and the earth
but,
just
but
melts.
Here's I mean, just I to mean, use the analogy.
The rich people of the world are the U.S. in that analogy.
Right.
Well, no, I wouldn't use it like that.
Well,
we're the imperial core, and it's going to come home to
the ruling, not regular people.
Well, here's my point, is that the should, let's just use the government shutdown as an analogy, because in many ways, I think it's a very similar dynamic. The question is, if that's the analogy, how do you get, like, okay, the should would be great. If we could convince everybody, like, hey, you should care about the fact that there are community health centers that are losing their support for victims of domestic violence, which is one of those early things that happened in the government shutdown. And we would report on it and we would talk about it. And it was fairly disparate and people didn't feel it on a daily basis. And it didn't impact the most powerful people in the country. If there was a mechanism where we could jump ahead or flatten the time to when the flight attendants essentially said, we're going to strike and we're going to shut down the airlines.
Well, that's what
if we could do
climate,
that, even
that's what climate extinction
but
extinction rebellion.
Well,
they
I understand.
Yeah.
But if there was a way, because it didn't happen, right? The planes did not all ground. There was some, but basically the system did not collapse because it was averted. We made a political choice as a government. I mean, Trump did essentially made a political choice, was forced because it was imminent. If there was a way to have shortened that time.
So what I'm trying to
and
do.
Wait, let me finish.
Okay.
If there was a way to have shortened that time, you would have helped those victims of domestic violence, not because people were interested in helping them in terms of like that Donald Trump didn't care about those people. But because of the fear of this other imminent thing that happened to hit them in their locality. So that's the question.
No,
is,
I agree.
How do you create that sense? I understand the idea that, you know, justice, and I understand the idea of revolution.
I'll make it more specific,
but how do you make
saying.
That sense that this is going to implicate the people with power sooner than they think it will?
So I'll say, I mean, one, obviously it's really hard because I think partially though is I think there's a lot of people in power who already do anticipate that, and that is why there's like a bunker industry. But the other way of saying it, which is more specific to your point, is another way of framing like the Fiji example or more close to home examples, even Hurricane Sandy, right, is to actually flip it and be like, these are examples of the fact that this is already here and it's immediate and it's pressing. And you can't dodge it. So even if you don't have, like, you know, like, and if you wanted to extend the government shutdown analogy, then maybe like, okay, you don't care about these centers being shut down, but that's a signal that in a week your plane is going to be messed up.
Well, that's
so
the
maybe
point. You have
could
to go
use
back
it.
To the plane.
Yeah, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But I do think you need to, but I also do think you need to, at least whatever way you're doing it, whether out of self-interest or empathy, you need to frame it in a different way than these sort of like overarching, like it's this planetary crisis and it's really bad and what are we going to do? Because in some ways, like I at least have been reading books like that since I'm like 15 years old. And they always make the same point. They always, the science is clear, the crisis is somewhere, and it's really bad, and we got to have a World War II type effort to do something about it.
That's my
so
point
we need
about
some
the
type
Fiji
of different
thing.
Frame.
I mean, the fact is that I think it would be more convincing to say to someone like, the flight attendants are going on strike, as opposed to there are domestic, like, the argument, the argument that this is the domestic violence victims are the canary in the coal mine, I don't think is as compelling as saying, like, that thing that's holding up the coal mine is shaking. And so, like, that, and so the question is, like, what is that in this context? And to a certain extent, like, you know, like, so I think the idea of, like, Miami's gone is going to have more import, at least in the context of the United States, than Fiji is suffering.
No, no, Miami is gone. And even, and I think even on a visceral level, I actually, we interviewed him years ago. I thought that guy, the explorer, no, oh, that was on Miami. But there was a guy who just did documentary films where he hiked the glaciers.
Right.
And he literally just showed you. Like, it wasn't all these charts and all these arguments. He's just like, 3 years ago, this was here.
Right.
Now it's here.
I remember that guy.
And Miami will eventually be gone. Like, I don't think we're going to have to look 10 years that hard for signs of climate change damaging regular people's lives here in the Imperial Core, where people have, you know, massively more political power per person than they do in the developing world.
I do have to say, though, I am not here to plan for the post-nuclear war revolution. Like, I think in terms of, like, climate change, I think, one, the policy is really important. I think that's why Dave Wallace Wells stressed, like, how much we subsidize fossil fuel industries.
Word.
And it's also sorts of things like, just like the Dakota Access Pipeline, how much that like those protests affect the bottom lines of those companies and their plans going forward, and how that they, their actual nuts and bolts of how they basically poison the earth. We need to throw a wrench in all that stuff. And that includes policy. It also includes the people at Dakota Access Pipeline that might have, like, cut a hydraulic hose here or there.
Yeah, but
like,
if you think that progressive government is going to save us, like, those protests were violently repressed by the Obama government.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well,
ultimately, though,
the state government in Dakota, and Obama was flippable, which
He ultimately flipped.
And the problem with the Dakota Access Pipeline is most of the land that they were putting the pipeline on was private land. The only time that the state had any power over that was when they were going over rivers. And, like, I think they should have had way more a role in that, in laying pipelines. Like, the entire pipeline, that should be the government's doing. There shouldn't be private pipelines.
That's insane.
Companies.
That is where I think framing that as, like, a radical position, we need to get as quickly as possible, we need to make the public ownership of things like pipelines and oil companies like we did with Medicare for All, because that shouldn't be a radical notion at all.
All right. In the meantime, we got to take a break. We are in desperate need of going to the fun half, various reasons.
That wasn't the fun half?
That was not the fun half.
I think if you look at the way Adidas,
so go into the fun half,
and
we'll I can't tell. Is this like an inside joke with one person, or is
no?
Like,
I mean,
we
also
talking about
Puma
before?
As well. I mean, there's a lot of work.
Or are you literally getting money for product placement? And the joke
that's
is
what I asked
it.
Earlier.
Yeah, irony. All right, go ahead.
Jesus. Adidas is really scraping the bottom of the barrel, though, if they're looking to
endorse
it. With all due respect.
You only insult yourself when you say that, Sam.
No. No, I'm insulting you. it's an athletic brand. You just don't come off as the most athletic.
Oh, no. I mean, certainly in this office. Matt's athletic.
I think we're going to be I think the boxing thing is going to come up. Look at Brendan's look.
Brendan's good.
I think we do basketball.
Yeah, let's do a basketball thing.
I don't want you to get injured. Listen, you bitch, for a couple of weeks.
I'll be fine.
basketball, and I hurt my foot.
Basking in the victory will take care of all pain.
Fucking
believe me.
Feeling your fucking...
How are you on playing basketball?
Ass.
Are you good?
My stomach. I was good when I played, but I haven't played for years. When was the last time you played?
It doesn't matter.
When was the last time you played?
If you're good, you're good.
Okay, then I'm good.
Yeah,
I had a nice fadeaway jumper, and I did it in Worcester.
I did.
I was you know what? Put it this way, and I'm sure that I would have done very well at your Jewish YMCA games that you were playing in, Sam.
Well, first of all,
JCA
the YMCA
or whatever you were playing. Yeah, Sam was just like, all
Jewish
right, fellas.
Young Christian, young male Christian.
JCA, whatever.
That's great.
I would have done incredibly well.
Let's save this for the fun half.
We've actually thought about softball, though.
Yeah. Oh, softball, let's do.
Jews can play basketball. Have you seen Bernie making those baskets?
We all can play basketball. Jews are good because basketball favors a certain sort of witty dishonesty. It's in our genes. There was a presentation that I saw once where they talked about how basketball was racialized, and they went back to the first like racist commentaries on basketball, and it was actually on Jews. And there was lines like,
it's very Jewy.
The Jews are good at basketball because it requires a certain degree of deception.
Amari Stoudemire.
And this is real stuff.
I'm going left. No, I'm not. I'm going right. All right.
I had a fadeaway jumper.
Just a reminder,
folks, Dad?
This program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, for just pennies a day, we give you extra content, we give you commercial free, and you support the free show. Also, justcoffee.co-op, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. That means tonight is Tuesday night. Michael, what is happening on the Michael Brooks Show?
Well, first we are going to have it. What is it called, Matt, again?
Mukbang.
We're going to be eating our survival food bucket to celebrate 2,000 patrons, which we're already pretty well over now. When we get to 3,000 patrons, we will do something pleasant.
Have beers.
Fun. Yeah, we're going to have some beers, and we'll live stream that. Pretty Bad Lefty, Chad Vigorous, BJ Sutton is with us tonight. We're talking about nerdery, Nate Silver, Elizabeth Warren, why it's a problem.
I met that guy last week at the Katie Halper Show. He's pretty cool.
He's a very, very cool guy. And we're also going to be talking about the distinction within foreign and military policy between Sanders and Warren, and also some pretty important on a wonkery level loopholes that are in her green military plan, which could sort of, if you give a military officer a waiver, if some type of green requirement might quote unquote threaten national security, that might disincentivize the whole process. So we're going to talk about that and plenty of other things. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We'll probably be feasting at around 6.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada.
What are you guys eating?
I'm
joking.
I'd come up with something funny for that. Milkshakes. We're having milkshakes.
Nice.
The official vegan food of Antifa. Yes, of course. I don't do well with dairy. Andy, AP Andy, our producer, hath returned from the first ever Trotskyism conference in Cuba. And he did some interviews with some people while he was there. He's got an interview with Isabel Diaz Torres from Anarchist Library Abra in Havana, and Simon Rodriguez from Venezuela Voices. So Isabel Diaz Torres was arrested last week for organizing a parade against homophobia in Cuba. The government still does not like you to do your own protests there. So she's going to talk about that. And Simon Rodriguez is part of the Partido Socialismo y Libertad, that is part of the left opposition to Maduro in Venezuela. So that is coming out tomorrow. And I'm excited to listen to it. I haven't listened to it yet.
Matt.
Literary Hangover, The Song of Hiawatha is the most recent episode that's just been put onto YouTube. Later this week, actually, maybe Thursday night, patrons will get the Margaret Fuller episode. She's sort of the leading feminist and socialist of the transcendental movement, and the first female foreign correspondent. She was a correspondent during the 1848 revolutions in Europe, where she became more of a socialist. That'll be out on Saturday for everybody. Literary Hangover. Check it out.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. Fun half coming up.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.